my thoughts are other thoughts. I always think immediately of Imam Ali and what a humble life he led, though, of course, he could have, in theory, had access to the greatest wealth. He was the greatest warrior. He was the, let's say, the initiator, the founder of Arabic grammar. He was a philosopher. He was a metaphysician and everything. And yet, he led a life, we could probably even say, even below average in terms of his lifestyle. But obviously, this is something that matters to our martyrs. Welcome back. This is HZ and I'm English Radio. And so I'm talking about being average, and being average is, you know, something we actually can aspire to, even though you might think it's a little bit of a paradox. How can we aspire? To aspire is to sort of look up, to reach higher to some lofty goal. And then you would think, well, being average, isn't that below that? But, you know, actually being average as a Muslim means that we've really reached this understanding where we are humble and we don't want to appear better, superior to anyone else, be it in, let's say, our wealth, sort of appearance, or let's say in a display or demonstration of our knowledge. And obviously some of these people who are extremely humble, and I've mentioned Imam Ali and everything he did, and obviously in his display of knowledge probably too, and I've just mentioned His Eminence the Sayyid. Even if a person is extremely knowledgeable, and we could, for example, also take the example of Imam Khomeini, they are the most concerned to sort of not be boastful, to not appear as if they know more than us, more than the other person, more than another expert, more than another scholar. Of course, for example, in the life of the Sayyid, he could have bought the best cars, the best houses, but obviously he didn't. He wanted to be the average. And he also taught this to his family. So he expected the same thing from the children. And that obviously is something we can think about in our lives. Because to some extent, obviously, when our children are going about their lives at work or at uni or just in the street mixing with everyone, people also see their parents and the rest of the family in our children. So that if they see that, for example, our children are hugely ostentatious and driving the most expensive car, they might think, well, what do their parents teach them? But, you know, this is another thing we should just remember when we're raising our children, that inshallah we can also instill this idea of humility and also modesty, inshallah. So inshallah you've gained some extra reminders or thoughts from today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
Humanitarian aid has not entered Gaza for nearly a month due to the Zionist regime's blockade. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, Hoda Hellas enjoyed a brief respite during the first days of the latest 2-month ceasefire. She lived with her family of eight in a makeshift tent in Al-Wehda Street, central Gaza City, after their house in Ash-Shajaya was bombed by an Israeli regime airstrike in 2023. She and her family had a plan for various dishes they wanted to cook during Ramadan. That plan was turned upside down on March 2nd, when the Zionist regime closed the borders, halting the entry of all humanitarian aid, food, and goods into Gaza. The renewed blockade has brought the enclave to the brink of famine once again. Hoda said, "We used to cook a variety of dishes every day, but now, for over 20 days, all we've had is rice. Now it's starting to give me severe stomach cramps." Recently, the United Nations Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, said in its latest update that the Zionist regime's ban on entry of aid has continued for nearly a month and that no aid entered the enclave throughout this period. All requests by humanitarian agencies to coordinate access with Israeli authorities have been denied. Moreover, Israeli regime attacks killed eight humanitarian workers since its unilateral decision to resume hostilities on Gaza on March 18th, bringing the total number of aid workers killed by Israeli regime army in Gaza to 399. Ellis recalled, when the blockade was imposed, the shops were empty within hours. And what was left was too expensive. Even the charity distributions, which once offered a variety of meals, have dwindled, now providing only small servings of rice at the time of iftar. After days of eating little more than rice, Hoda couldn't sleep at night, suffering from severe stomach pain and colic. She was diagnosed with a stomach infection 2 weeks ago. She said, "Doctors advised me to eat healthy food and avoid canned goods, but there is nothing else to eat except the low-quality charity distribution. I'm surviving on eating only bread and cheese when possible." Hella's mother, Manal, 52, was also supposed to eat healthy food. She suffered a heart attack and high blood pressure at the beginning of this month. Hoda thinks that the main reason for her mother's deteriorating health is living in the harsh conditions in the tents, including the dire lack of food and clean water for drinking. Hoda recalled, "During Ramadan, my mother used to prepare a beautiful spread of chicken, meat and vegetables, carefully preparing each dish for the family. Now, she looks at us helplessly, asking us to hang on, hoping that the starvation will not last much longer." Before the ceasefire, Hoda and her family had been displaced to Khan Yunis in the southern part of Gaza. She said, "We were not able to find a piece of bread. For 2 months, we lived only on canned hummus." During the ceasefire, Hoda and her family feared the return of war and the famine that would inevitably follow. And that is what was happening. She said, "It's unfair to live in starvation again." Ahmad Ramda, 38, also struggles to find something to eat or feed his four children during the Zionist regime's current complete blockade on the entry of humanitarian aid, including food. He thinks that the blockade's impact is even worse than last year. He said, "We no longer have the energy to flee from one place to another, fetch water, or even recover from wounds due to the lack of food and medical care. They want us to be homeless, reliant on limited humanitarian aid. But all we want is for the borders to open so we can work, make a living, and live in peace." He was once a driver, but his car was bombed by Israeli regime airstrikes in November 2023 while he and his family were evacuating. His house was also destroyed, his father killed, and many other family members were wounded. Now, Ramda and his family live in a tent on Omar Mukhtar Street in the central Gaza Strip. Ahmad said, "My children cry every day, refusing to eat the lentils or rice from the charity distributions. They ask me for chicken, meat and fruits. Their mother even lied to them, telling them she put minced meat in the food, but it melted while cooking. I wish to be dead before the moment I see my children starve to death." In January 2024, Ramda and his wife, Sana, welcomed their baby girl, Misk, into the world in their displacement tent in Deir el-Balah, in the middle of the Gaza Strip. However, due to the lack of proper nutrition, Sana had a difficult time breastfeeding Misk. Tragically, Misk died of malnutrition in August 2024. Ramda explained through tears, "Sana struggled to breastfeed Misk due to the lack of healthy food and because we couldn't afford what was available in the markets." Meanwhile, his 10-year-old daughter, Jory, has been battling dehydration. He said, "I lost one daughter, and I'm terrified of losing another before the borders open and we get food. I appeal to the world to end our suffering. Not for us, the adults, but for the sake of our children who are deprived of their most basic rights." Mazen Ma'ruf, 48, a farmer, struggles to survive with his 11-member family. During the ceasefire, he and his six sons had planted tomatoes and onions on their farmland in Beit Lahia, hoping to feed themselves and make a living from their crops. But when the Zionist regime broke the ceasefire on March 18th, their plans were shattered. Ma'ruf said, "Israeli regime artillery and aerial shelling began suddenly in the morning. We could only take our tent. We didn't know where to go." Ma'ruf and his family could hardly find an empty place to set up their tent in Yarmouk neighborhood due to the crowded movement of displaced people. They are still struggling to find something to eat as they have no money and were unable to bring any food with them when they evacuated. The north of the Gaza Strip, especially Beit Hanun, was once considered the food basket of Gaza, but has been decimated by the war. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, at least 67.6% of cropland in northern Gaza has been destroyed by the Zionist regime. Ma'ruf explained, "We only eat when charity distributions come or when others share their canned food. My family and I are sick and suffering from malnutrition. We don't want to rely on humanitarian aid. We want the war to stop now and to live in peace and dignity."
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English. English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavit Afwai. Palestinian doctor and five-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Izzaddin Abu-Laish has experienced immense personal tragedy. In January 2009, an Israeli tank shell hit his home, killing his three daughters and one of his nieces. And in October 2024, 22 members of his extended family were killed in Jabalia refugee camp by an Israeli airstrike. Also known as the Palestinian doctor or Gaza doctor, he now joins us in this edition of Unscripted. Izzaddin Abu-Laish, welcome to Unscripted.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Before, during, and after, this is a timeline that I'm hoping this interview will take us through in terms of the journey that you've had. And I'd like to start out with the timeline before your book, which certain events led to you writing this book called I Shall Not Hate, A Gaza Doctor's Journey on the Road to Peace and Human Dignity. Now, we are aware of the fact that you have devoted your life to not only medicine, but also reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, at the same time, there have been some wars. Aside from Operation Cast Lead back in 2008-09, Pillar of Defense in 2012, and Protective Edge in 2014. Did any of these wars or anything else alter that devotion that you had when it came to Palestinian reconciliation with Israel?
Thank you so much. It's important, hope you read the book and to understand what is the story of the Palestinian people. The book, I Shall Not Hate, it's about a human universal story from where did I come as a Palestinian refugee and a descendant of parents who survived the Nakba. I am a refugee who was born, raised, and lived in Jabalia refugee camp in the teeming poverty, in the suffering, in the intimidation, the continuous, protracted, transgenerational and intergenerational trauma. But in spite of that, we as Palestinians, we are fighting just to survive. And when I wrote my book to show the world who are the Palestinians, who are hearing about the Palestinians, they are not supposed just to hear, to know who are the Palestinians. Palestinian people are people like others, with hopes, with the plans, with the dreams, with names, and they succeed, and they are achievers. And when I wrote this book after the tragedy of the killing of my daughters and my niece, even afterwards, when tens of my family members were murdered after what we call October 7, I said it clearly in my book, if I could know that my daughters were the last sacrifice in the way to peace. But what is peace? Peace is not just a word. Peace is a way of life. Peace is a relationship. It's about justice, about dignity, about freedom, about rights, about equality. Peace is not going to be achieved by war. War will never bring peace. We need to achieve justice, equality, dignity, freedom, and rights for all. And that's why when I wrote, I Shall Not Hate, it means I will never be broken. I will never be defeated. I will never give up. I am more determined than before to continue to bring justice, freedom, dignity to my daughters and to my people.
Well, it's obviously very commendable that you have this passion that's very noticeable in your the way that you have delivered that to us. You could hear that in your voice. And that's what we want to find out from you, as I'm sure many, including Palestinians and non-Palestinians, regarding how you talk about justice, peace, and equality. I'd like to point out to, if it's okay to talk about this, the time that the Israeli tank shell hit your home, which unfortunately led to the killing of your daughters back in 2009. If you're comfortable with this, I'm going to go ahead and ask the question, because it's really important to highlight how we understand this was broadcast live. You were supposed to appear on Israeli TV, from what we understand. Then it came to symbolize the war, based on how it was reported. And you said 2 days later, then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who said knows you, announced a unilateral ceasefire. I'd like to find out your thoughts then in terms of your viewpoint on Ehud Olmert, because he was responsible during the war at that point to order U.S. bombs to actually shell civilian Palestinian civilians. We know that some 1,400 were killed, including some 300 children. Do you think that he really had an emotion attached after what you came to function as when 2 days later a ceasefire was announced?
You know, it's important. What is war? War is not about the soldier who is going to kill and to be killed. War is about innocent human beings, about women, children who are sitting there and waiting to have life and to continue life. War is not to be documented, but to be prevented and to be avoided. And that's what is happening at that time in 2008 and 2009, when we were under bombardment and continuous bombardment. Who is going to be next? I was the voice of the Palestinian people to spread to the message. And at that time, what is most painful? I lost faith in the humanity. The world is watching and was watching what happened in 2008, 2012, 14, 18, 21, 22, and 23 until now. They are watching it. We as Palestinians, we play the same color as others. We are human. It exposed the atrocities of the world and the bias and the indifference of the world, even complicit world. So at that time, I believe in every bad thing, there is something good. I am a person of faith. I believe in that. So I directed my face to God, and this tragedy, the killing of my daughter, came in the right time when I called my colleague, because I worked in Israel as a Palestinian doctor. I want the Israelis to know who are the Palestinians. And the Palestinians are human beings, and they give a humanity. And when it was broadcasted live, it helped in exposing the lies that we are killing the innocent human beings. These are the daughters of the doctor who delivered us, who helped us, and that's what is needed. And that's why when Ehud Olmert announced unilateral ceasefire, but do we need to be killed in order to save lives? We should save the life, because every human life is precious. War is not to be stopped. War is to be prevented and to be avoided, and to replace it with justice, with equality, with the freedom, dignity, with rights, and to live by these values. Even what is happening these days after what we call it October 7, with this genocide, with this ethnic cleansing, with this mass destruction, mass displacement, mass starvation, Gaza Strip, now it's a ghost, it's a childless, it's helpless, it's foodless, it's homeless, nothing is there. Under the witness of the world, it exposed this world, the hypocrisy and mediocrity of our world. Where are they from these human rights they are talking about by lip service? It's time to live by these values, not in a biased or indifferent or double standards. Palestinians are people like others, and that's what I see it in the world. It's a challenge to the world, and it's an opportunity to the world to start their change in their behaviors. What kind of world do we live in? Is it civilized? Is it human? I don't believe that. The administrations of what we call the Western civilized world, they are hypocritic, they are mediocritic, they are humanly, ethically, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. And Gaza Strip put them under the test. And the test is there in Gaza Strip. It's time for the international community to live by these values. And the first thing, to implement it for the Palestinians. And we need accountability and liability of the perpetrators. Accountability is essential, crucial for the dignity and to achieve justice and equality.
See, the things that you say obviously are very well noted here. And I don't think there's anybody that can disagree with that. What I'm trying to understand here from you, and I'm sure many others who will watch this, is to understand the mentality that the Israelis have versus the approach that you have. You know, we're looking at, for example, this previous wars, including this particular genocidal war, where there were high precision weapons that were used. These are weapons that are capable of pinpoint strikes that can hit within a meter of their targets. Why am I mentioning this? Is because there are many targets by the Israeli regime using technology such as what has been used in these weapons, but yet you have so many civilians that have been killed. The stats speak for themselves in terms of the genocidal war, which then puts into perspective and puts up the argument versus what you have said, that the Israeli regime doesn't really care about civilian lives. Do you think that that is a valid point to make here?
Yeah, it's when you speak about the weapons used, everything in life has been used, weaponized, militarized, politicized, and normalized against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Everything, food, water, medications, health, schools, weapons, everything has been used against the Palestinians. But the Palestinian people are a living nation, and they will never give up or forget their rights. And the world, it's time for the world to understand it and to stand by justice to save the Palestinians from the atrocities of these weapons. These weapons, as I said, and those people who were murdered, who were killed in the sake of freedom, justice, to be injected and to be used. The world will be guilty. The world is guilty if they didn't transform this into justice, freedom, dignity for the Palestinians. And it's important to understand Palestinians, they don't want to delete anyone. They are asking for the most precious thing. It's the justice and the freedom for their people. It's the only nation on earth which is deprived of its freedom. And that's what we need to understand. If they believe in a human life, I want to ask the world, do we bleed as Palestinians the same blood as the Americans, as the Germans, as those Western countries? We bleed the same color. So it's time for them to stand for the humanity and to humanize, not to politicize, not to fuel the war by adding more weapons to kill the Palestinians. We need to add more human values, more dignity, more justice. We need more water to put the fire off and the war off.
Okay, you again have zoomed in on things that you have told us before here, especially when it comes to human values. And I would like to use a quote that you actually said while you held the position of a doctor, the first Palestinian doctor that held a position at an Israeli hospital. You said, "I want the Israelis not to see the Palestinians as workers working for them, or only to see them in the child who was throwing stones during the first Intifada. I want them to see the Palestinians as equal, as talented, as human as they are." But you have Israeli officials right now who have talked about Palestinians as human animals to make Gaza a slaughterhouse. You can see where this divide is. It sounds like it's in a completely different world, the approach you have and the value that Palestinians have.
And that's what I want the Israelis and the world to see as Palestinians. To see us as a human and as equal. When I practice medicine, if you go to any hospital, whether in Iran, whether in America, whether in Canada, everywhere, all of the patients for me are equal. The only difference is the diagnosis and the type of the disease. And that's the message I want all of those political leaders from the Israeli side in particular, and the Americans and the Western countries, that they are talking about equality, human values, and they don't live by these values. They talk about it. It's time for them to walk the talk. For me, when I deliver a baby in any hospital, the only difference is not based on ethnicity, religion, color, or name. The medicine for me and health are a human equalizer, stabilizer, socializer, harmonizer, and sustenizer. Why we deliver them equally and they are the same once they are inside the hospital. But once they step outside the hospital and to give them names or the color to appear on them, we start to discriminate. It's a kind of discrimination, and discrimination is a destructive disease and it will never persist. What do you expect from the people who are discriminated against? They have to fight for their freedom, for their rights.
Well, that's the point that is important here. You have said right now that it's time for them to walk the talk. I mean, they have not done that. And in the bigger picture, when you take a look at the past 70 years or so, you see that the Palestinian issue has not been resolved. And at the same time, their rights, their restrictions, the violations, and of course their land has been chewed away and taken away from them all this time. In terms of what happened with Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, I'd like to open that up. Back in December 19, 2023, there was a Guardian Focus YouTube video. There were pictures of dead bodies that were being shown. They said, these are our nephews, our nieces, our sisters. I don't know if you remember that. At that point, the number of Palestinians that were killed, which is again December of 2023, were roughly around 10,000, a number that rose to 50,000 at this point, and maybe even more. In that context, where does peace between Israelis and Palestinians rank? How could that happen after this Operation Al-Aqsa flood with the number of Palestinians that have been killed by the Israeli regime?
The peace, as I said to that, it's not a through killing, and this will never bring safety or security to Israelis. The Israelis are less safe, secure, unless the Palestinians are free, dignified, equal, to be independent, and their safety, security is from the Palestinian safety, security, future, and the freedom. That's the most important thing, but we need the world. As you mentioned, more than 50,000 Palestinians are killed. About 70,000 Palestinians are killed. Until now, many of them are under the rubble. And who are killed? It's the children. As I said, Gaza Strip has turned into a ghost. It's childless, parentless, homeless, lifeless, foodless, schoolless. What else is remaining? It's a crime. As I said, it's a crime against the humanity. It's the crisis of the humanity, and the world is watching it. So we need, why it's repeated, we said it, my daughters were killed in January 2009. But why it's repeated afterwards, we say never again, never again, never again. You know why it's repeated? Because lack of accountability, lack of liability. It's time for the world to stand, and Israeli administrations and leaders should be accountable to what is happening. And that's what is needed from the international community, to stand up and to speak out. And those perpetrators, those criminals, to be accountable. Accountability is the guarantee to stability and to achieve the peace we are looking for, and to follow the international institutions. Why do we have the United Nations? Why do we have the ICC? The last thing to control stability and to give stability to our world is the international institutions and the rule of law. The rule of law with one standard, not with double standards or being indifferent or selective in these rules of law. And that's what is important. That's why I said it's the test to our world to live by these values. And unless we implement and endorse these values based on rule of law, on all, the rule of law is our umbrella, and it equalizes between all, not based on ethnicity or political agenda.
Okay, Doctor, you talked about accountability, which raises the question as to whether that's going to be something that can actually be achievable. I'm guessing that you obviously are talking about the Israeli regime officials. Perhaps you might be talking about the U.S. also, who's providing the assistance and the protection when it comes to Israel being shielded, for example, at the UN. You also talk about the rule of law, but I'm sure when you talk about the rule of law in Israel, it's not something that can apply. Obviously, that, I'm guessing, is something that's a given because of what Israel has done, not only in this genocidal war, but previously in terms of violations of Palestinians. We want to figure out how it is that your approach with the reconciliation that you have recommended is actually something that is applicable right now or not, based on how the landscape has changed. Do you think that that is still something that we should strive for?
No, reconciliation, when we speak about reconciliation, what do we need? What do we mean by reconciliation? Reconciliation is to resume functionality, is the rehabilitation, to go back to the right situation, and should be based on the truth and acknowledging what is happening based on the diagnosis of the problem. The Palestinian people are under occupation, are colonized, are oppressed, are suffering, and the Israelis are occupier and oppressing. So we need to equalize with them and to end the occupation. And that's what is important. It's not just reconciliation, let us move together. There should be certain requirements to achieve it, to end the occupation, the Palestinians to get their right, to get their freedom, to get their independence. And that's what is important. Without that, it's not reconciliation. No one can coexist with a disease. No one can coexist with oppression, with occupation. We want to coexist as equal, as a free. And we can reconcile it if these needs are fulfilled. And as you said, the rule of law, I fully believe in this world, there is nothing called unconditional impunity, unconditional support. We you need this support to be based on good acts. And what the Americans, as you said, the American administration is complicit in the genocide committed against the Palestinians. And what they did and the Israelis are doing are destructive to them, destructive to the Palestinians, and destructive to the world. It's time to save the world from these destructive political, really, strategic, really brutal acts. It's time. We need the rule of law and all to be accountable. And I appeal to the world, because you see it these days in the world. The world is polarized, is divided. The administrations in one side taking one side, and the public on the other side. The public is starting to be aware of what is happening and the injustices against the Palestinians.
Okay, I'd like to point to a joint poll. This poll was conducted by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, PSR, in Ramallah, and the International Program in Conflict Resolution and Mediation at Tel Aviv University. The results of this poll is somewhat shocking. It says that the Jewish Israelis were asked to select one of the four options that described the Palestinians' intentions on October 7th and then the current genocide. And one of the results of the poll said that Jewish Israelis, 66% of them, selected that they want to commit genocide against Palestinians. 27% believe the aim is to conquer land and expel the Jews, the most extreme of four options. If you have 66% of Jewish Israelis who think that there should be genocide committed against Palestinians, you could imagine what Israeli officials think. Therefore, this comes to the notion as to where do we go from there? Because we have reached now in a point in this conflict where it has been taken to another level. It's not the same scenario as before.
No, it's the same continuity, because the Israeli community, the Israeli political map is moving to the right wing. It's not new. 66, even this is hopeful. 66, I thought that you would say it's 86. So I am sure they are going to the extreme right wing government, because the current Israeli government administration is controlled by right wing extreme fanatic government under the leadership of Netanyahu, Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and I hear all of the incitements. What do they speak? What do they say about the Palestinians? Even the quotes they are describing the Palestinians are war criminals, are war crime against the humanity. But this is, and why all of this? We need to ask why they should be accountable to that. And what prevents accountability is the complicit and unconditional support by the American administration and the Western countries. So it's time for these countries to save the world from these self-destructive acts and the encouragement of the Israeli administration to take this path and to have it. It's a wrong administration, and that's what is happening. We need to resume trust, otherwise we live in jungle. The strong get to eat the weak. Where are we from the rule of law? So as I said, it's time for the world to stand by. And I see what happened October 7th, it didn't come out of the blue, because it has been the cumulative acts for more than seven decades. We as Palestinians, we have been suffering since the Nakba, since 1948. So it came to expose the world. And that's what happened with October 7th. And I see it as an opportunity. It's a silver lining opportunity for the world to reflect on it and to understand the causes behind it, not just to blame. The root causes of it, and what can they do to make the world? We need a reform in our world.
Uh-huh. Well, you just touched on the whole issue of this program, this conversation we're having, where you talk about, if I understood you correctly, October 7th being an opportunity. The opportunity that you're talking about when it comes to the Israeli regime and the U.S. really showed itself when it comes to the U.S. President Donald Trump, who has justified the U.S. taking over the Gaza Strip, right? He's backtracked a little bit, but he wants to transform it into a real estate development. The Riviera of the Middle East is what he calls it, to build apartments on over dead bodies that are probably still below there somewhere. That's the type of rule of law that doesn't apply to this U.S. president and doesn't apply, obviously, to the Israeli regime officials. How can there be any, therefore, advancements when it comes to anything that has to deal with reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis.
Yeah, you know, I smile when I hear this. When President Trump was elected, and they consider him elected by democratic election. But if any other country to elect someone like Trump in any other country, they would stand against the election of someone like President Trump, who is completely biased, who is fanatic, and he is leading to disturbance in our world. He wants to buy Gaza. To buy it from whom? To buy it from 2.3 million or 13 million Palestinians? From 13 million Palestinians, it's not only for one. And it's not a real estate that he is dealing with that. And that's the issue of materialized world. He thinks of everything as materialized, as a developer, as construction, as a real estate. Palestine is what we call it, is a holy, sacred land. It's what we call it, Ardwaqf. Ardwaqf, no one can sell it. And it's owned by humanity, by people who own it. And no one is allowed and can give up 1 millimeter of Palestine. And that's, he has to understand it. Palestine and Gaza Strip was a Rivera before Trump was there. It was a Rivera, and Palestinian people are rooted there. It's not about the land, it's about the history, about the culture, about the memory. I can say to you about the holy people who were killed in the sake of justice, equality, freedom. The first thing when I go to Gaza, and I am waiting to go to Gaza, the first thing when I go, before I go to my home, I visit the graves of my daughters, my mother, my father. I will go to visit the graves of my sisters, my nephews, my nieces, to say to them, we didn't forget, we will never give up, we promise you, and I gave them the oath, I will never rest, I will never relax until I meet them. I am a Muslim with deep faith. I believe one day I will meet them, but to meet them with the big gift that their holy souls, noble blood, were never wasted. It was transfused, injected into a vein of hope, justice, dignity, equality, and the freedom of the Palestinian people. We all feel guilty if these holy, sacred human souls were wasted.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you so much for joining us in this program. It was very enlightening, and thank you for the compassion that you delivered to us, Professor Dr. Izzadeen Aboulaish. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of Unscripted. You were just listening to Professor Dr. Izzadeen Aboulaish from Ikava Tafwai. Thanks for being with us.
Iqra bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhal muzammil qum al-layla illa qalila. نصفه أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
فدعوتك ربي بقرآن جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفران يا من ينجينا إحسان.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, Brother Mahdi. Assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. I'm very glad to be with you as always.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, this program, Let's Recite the Quran, consists of several parts. First, we're going to talk about a famous Quran reciter. Then, we'll listen to a recitation by that reciter preceded by its English translation. After, Brother Muhammad will analyze that recitation. And beside these parts, we're going to have some other interesting Quranic segments which will be presented to you. So please stay tuned. Today we are going to listen to a recitation by Sheikh Muhammad Imran. He was an Egyptian reciter who was born in Suhaj Governorate in 1944. He lost his eyesight when he was 1 year old. He managed to memorize the Noble Quran completely at the age of 10 under the care of Sheikh Abdul Rahim Al-Misri. Then he learned Tajweed under the care of Sheikh Muhammad Khabbaz. In 1955, he moved to Cairo and got familiar with many Quran reciters and munshids, including Sheikh Muhammad Musa. I'm sure the audience that you know what Mubtahil or Munshid is. Munshid is someone who recites religious songs and nasheeds. And Mubtahil is someone who recites supplications. As a religious Munshid, he followed the style of Sheikh Ali Mahmud. He had such a unique voice that after entering radio, he became one of the outstanding Munshids and Mubtahils of Egypt. He had one of the most complete voices, according to experts. Sheikh Muhammad Imran passed away in 1994 at the age of 50. May Allah bless him. Now it's time to listen to the recitation of Suratul Hijr, verses 85 to 87, recited by Sheikh Muhammad Imran, preceded by its English translation. Let's enjoy it.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful. And we created not the heavens and the earth and all that is between them except with truth, and the hour is surely coming. So overlook their faults with gracious forgiveness. Verily, your Lord is the all-knowing Creator. And indeed, we have bestowed upon you the 7 repeatedly recited verses and the grand recital.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما خلقنا السماء ولقد آتيناك 7 من المثاني والقرآن العظيم فاصفح الصفح الجميل إن ربك هو الخلاق العظيم
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, you're still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And what you just listened to was recitation of Surah Al-Hijr, verses 85 to 87, recited by Sheikh Muhammad Imran. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, this recitation by Sheikh Muhammad Imran was in the riwayah of Hafs an Asim. In fact, Sheikh Muhammad Imran always, and he only uses this method of recitation, which is Hafs an Asim, in all of his recitations. And his tajweed is very good, and also his fasaha is excellent. Okay, fasaha means the correct Arabic accent of the Quran.
Yes.
Okay. Fasih means eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the accent which is needed for Quran recitation. And probably the biggest factor, okay, concerning fasaha is
the pronunciation of fatha.
Fatha and alif ul mad. And of course, also the makharij wal huruf. But the most important is the way of pronouncing fatha and alif ul mad, because there are many ways that you can pronounce fatha and alif ul mad, but there aren't many ways that you can pronounce dhamma and kasra.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For example, if you say wa ma khalaqna as-samawat, this is, you know, you're opening
one
your
way.
Mouth too much. But if you say وَمَا خَلَقُنَا السَّمَاوَاتِ, this is, your mouth is a lot more closed.
Yeah.
It's not too open. So this affects fasaha. And for fasaha in the Quran, we want the fatha to be very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be too wide. If you say وَمَا خَلَقُنَا, see, that's incorrect. In some languages, the fatha is like this. Okay, but in Arabic, it should be narrower. The mouth opens in a certain way. And you have to learn the exact way that the mouth opens. And also the tongue should be in a specific position when pronouncing fatha. And Muhammad Imran, Sheikh Muhammad Imran, his fasaha is very good compared to other reciters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now let's talk about the tajweed in these verses. As we said, his tajweed is very good, Muhammad Imran. He observes the rules of tajweed precisely.
That's right.
وَمَا خَلَقَنَا خَلَقَنَا
خَلَقَنَا.
Exactly. We have a خَا with تَفْخِيم because it's a letter of إِسْتِعْلَاء. And we have a قَاف with تَفْخِيم. And also قَلْقَلَا, because قَاف is also a letter of إِسْتِعْلَاء.
Yes. And in between,
we have two letters of istifal in between. So we have to make sure that the letter of istifal does not affect the letter of tafkhim and vice versa. If you say, وَمَا خَلَقَنَسْ, see, that's all tafkhim. Or if you say, وَمَا خَلَقَنَسْ, خَا, خَا, the خَا should be with tafkhim. And also the قَاف. If you say, خَلَقَنَا الْقَا,
yes,
that's incorrect. قَا. The qaf also needs tafkhim.
We have one letter actually in between. One,
yes,
letter of istifal
one
in
letter
between.
One letter of istifal between.
That is.
And
lam.
Of course, after the last letter of istifal,
خلقه, then
we have a noon, which is also a letter of istifal.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
We have to be careful the letter after that letter is not affected either.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
وَمَا خَلَقْنَا السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِلَّا بِالْحَقِّ بالحق. The qaf has the lowest level of tafkhim.
Yes.
And Muhammad Imran is, he's very skilled in pronouncing these letters of isti'la with the kasra. He never says bilhaqqi. Qi, qi is incorrect. Bilhaqqi.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that the tafkhim is very low. وَإِنَّ السَّاعَةَ لَآتِيَةَ. We have two ta'u ta'neeth. السَّاعَةَ and لَآتِيَةٌ. The first one, we pronounce the ta, but the second one, if we do waqf, we have to pronounce the ta like
just
a
like
ha.
A ha.
Okay? La'atiyah. Okay. And we have a sali here, which means waqf is allowed, but continuation is preferred.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياة إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان هو القرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق هو
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Dozens of Palestinians were killed in the latest Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime continues its aggression on the besieged territory. Germany Army forces said they have shot down another US MQ-9 drone over Hodeidah and targeted US warships in the Red Sea with drones and cruise missiles. And the EU chief says the bloc is ready to respond to the latest US tariffs as Washington trading partners slam Trump for imposing new levies. Thank you so much for joining us. Our fourth story takes us to Palestine, where more Palestinians have fallen victim to Israel's incessant air and artillery strikes on Gaza, as regime's genocidal war rages unabated.